From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Florida has roughly 20% of all new coronavirus cases in the country, and hospitalizations in the state are breaking pandemic records. But Florida school districts are being forced to choose. If they require masks in schools this fall, they will lose state funding. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed an order last week giving the State Department of Education the power to withhold that money. Jessica Bakeman is an education reporter with member station WLRN in Miami, and she's here with us now. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how does the governor plan to keep kids safe in the classroom if they're not wearing masks in the middle of this very serious outbreak in Florida?
Well, I think the governor wants to leave decisions about how to keep kids safe to their parents. And also, he has said over and over that, you know, he doesn't think that state mandates or local government mandates work to stop the spread of COVID-19. Of course, experts would disagree, particularly when it comes to masks. And he actually had a press conference this morning that I did not attend, but the New York Times is reporting he was asked about the higher hospital admissions for children with COVID-19 in Florida. And reporter Patricia Mazzei tweeted from the press conference this morning that DeSantis rebuffed the reporter, saying that the reporter was blaming kids for not wearing masks and getting sick and calling the question deplorable.
Hmm. All right. Broward County Schools, those are around Fort Lauderdale, they'd said that they were going to enforce a mask rule anyway. But then last night, they backed down. They said they would comply with the governor's order. What can you tell us about that? Why the reversal?
So when Broward County School Board first voted to basically keep the mask mandate in place for the upcoming school year, which starts August 18th for Broward, that was before the governor had made this executive order, although he had said that if any school districts do try to mandate masks, that he would ask the state legislature to convene for a special legislative session to outlaw that. Instead of doing that legislative session, he ended up doing this executive order last Friday. And since then, the school board has said that they intend to comply with it. Obviously, they know that there's a lot of money at stake if they don't comply with it. They put out a statement basically saying, you know, we're going to do everything we can to encourage our community to get vaccinated and wear masks. And we're going to try to do all the other things that we can to try to mitigate the spread, including, you know, being careful about air quality in schools and dealing with sanitizing and that sort of thing. But I think it really comes down to the school board doesn't want to lose that money and expects that the governor will follow through with his threat.
And just briefly, how much money are we talking about?
It's hard to say, but probably tens of millions of dollars at least for each school, each of the bigger school districts.
You know, DeSantis is saying that he wants to protect parents' rights to choose. But if parents wanted to send their kids to school with a mask, the schools then presumably would have to find a way to enforce that, which could be complicated. What are you hearing from parents about all this?
I talked to a longtime education attorney this morning who says he's spoken with a handful of parents and also parent groups that are considering suing over this for exactly the reason that you explain. I've also spoke this morning with a Broward County school board member who said that she's been getting tons of emails from parents, not only asking, you know, how do I enroll my child in virtual school or homeschool so I don't have to send them to school where kids could be not wearing masks, but also requests to segregate students based on whether they're wearing masks or not. And I actually also spoke with an infectious disease specialist this morning who is one of the medical advisors for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And she said she's going to advise exactly that. If there are families who feel comfortable with taking the risk, put their kids in a classroom together. And if there are families that want to have their kids wear masks, then put those kids in a classroom together. The Broward County School Board member I talked to said that logistically that would likely be impossible.
All right. And just very briefly, I mean, what do you expect the upcoming school year to look like? Mostly normal?
I don't know that we could say it will be normal. I can't really tell you what it's going to look like. I know there's still a little bit of time before schools open. But I can tell you that Florida health officials are saying we absolutely must have universal masking in schools. And if we don't, particularly because of the Delta variant, it's going to continue to spread.
Jessica Bakeman at WLRN in Miami. Thank you.
Thank you.
More than 100 state lawmakers from across the country are in Washington, D.C. today to rally for federal legislation to protect voting rights. They are there alongside Democrats from Texas who fled the state to prevent Republicans from passing restrictions on voting. Protesters also marched at the state capitol in Austin.
What do we want?
We're voting rights!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
That group marched 27 miles to the state capitol over the weekend. Among them was former Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who joins me now on Skype. Welcome back.
Jane, thanks for having me.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being no risk at all and 10 being extremely at risk, how would you rate the health of voting rights in this country today?
It's at 10. And if there's a higher number I could choose, I would pick it. The president put it well in his speech in Philadelphia about 3 weeks ago. He said, "This is the single greatest attack on our democracy since the Civil War." And he included not only the voting restriction provisions and bills that are being considered or have been passed in dozens of states around the country, but he connected that to the big lie about election fraud in 2020 and ongoing fraudulent concerns that there is widespread, illegal voting, but connected it also to the violent insurrection attempt on the 6th of January and the fact that, the sanctum of our democracy was invaded by force for the first time since the War of 1812. When you put all that together, you realize that what Lincoln called the last best hope of earth might very well be lost unless we're willing to stand up and fight for it. And I think that's what you're seeing take place now across the country, and certainly here in Texas, where I really think we're on the front lines of this fight.
So you and your fellow activists have been trying to draw attention to these voting rights issues, not only in Texas, but of course around the country. You're advocating for a new federal legislation to protect voting rights. What do you want to see happen at the national level?
It's really important that the United States Senate pass a bill known as the For the People Act. It's a piece of voting rights legislation that has already passed the House of Representatives. And not only would it roll back voter suppression attempts in Texas and Florida and so many other states by, for example, mandating defined periods for early voting and ensuring that anyone who would like to vote by mail, especially in the middle of a pandemic, is able to do that. That bill is pending before the Senate right now. It would certainly be helped with a push from the president. That's what we're looking for right now.
Well, some activists have complained that President Biden has seemed more engaged on infrastructure than voting rights. Do you agree with that? And what would be your advice to him as he tries to juggle his priorities?
The physical infrastructure of this country is incredibly important, but it pales in comparison to the infrastructure of our democracy. If, for example, people cannot get to a polling place, or certain groups within a state or a county or in our country, like those voters with disabilities, low-income voters, very young and very old voters, and black and brown voters, if they are effectively and functionally kept from using their right to vote, then anything else that we want to do on any other policy issue, whether it's confronting climate before it's too late or pursuing racial justice, none of that's possible unless all of us can participate. And so I know that President Biden believes in this, but we do need more from him.
There are still 50 Texas Democrats, state lawmakers, who are in Washington, D.C., waiting out a special session in Texas. They've been there for 3 weeks now. They refuse to cooperate with Republicans in Texas who they say are attacking voting rights through proposed legislation. Last month, you gave Texas House Democrats $600,000 to continue their stay in Washington. They say they're bringing in reinforcements now from 20 states around the country for this final push to pressure lawmakers to forego their August recess until the Senate passes the For the People Act that you mentioned. I mean, how long can this strategy be effective?
I think they're providing some really necessary moral leverage and perhaps an example of political courage that is necessary. But, in the spirit of your question, there's only so much they can do. At some point, they'll have to return to Texas, where, by the way, they potentially face arrest, where they've already left, you know, their families and their homes, and in some cases, you know, young children for nearly a month. They've put it all on the line, and I hope that is going to be the necessary encouragement and shove to our president and the Democratic members in the Senate, who have a majority there, to pass voting rights legislation. But there's only so much they can do. And I really do feel like Texas has done its part. It's now time for the federal government to step up and do theirs.
Beto O'Rourke is a former congressman from Texas. Beto, thank you very much.
Thank you. Very grateful to you.
Today is Black Women's Equal Pay Day, which marks how far into 2021 Black women need to work in order to earn what white, non-Hispanic men earned in 2020. The gender wage gap persists in this country, and it's even more pronounced for Black women, who on average make just 63 cents to every dollar a white man earns for full-time, year-round work. Joining us now are Fatima Goss Graves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, and Venorica Tucker, who's a food service worker in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Fatima, let me start with you. Over the course of a career, this pay discrepancy leads to a wealth gap, not just a wage gap. Talk about how this all adds up.
Well, what we know is that for Black women in this country in particular, the wage gap, which might start small, but grows over time, and it increases their inability to retire, it increases their inability to save. And what it means is at the end of their lives, they are sometimes left with very meager savings or no savings at all. So they are shortchanged their entire working lives, and then they are shortchanged into retirement.
And the wage gap is really across the board, right? Low and high paid jobs in 94% of occupations.
That's right. You can look at every single type of occupation and you still find that Black women are paid less. And the gap overall is increased by the fact that Black women are more likely to be in jobs that disproportionately pay low wages, the sort of jobs that were cut pretty quickly with no net during the pandemic.
And it adds up to a loss of about $2,000 a month, $24,000 annually, and a staggering $964,000 over the course of a 40-year career.
You know, I found when you tell Black women that last statistic that we're talking about over the course of your career, it's almost $1 million in wages that are lost. That's when people pay attention. That's when they think about how that is life-changing money that changes experiences over generations.
Venorica, tell us how this wage gap has shaped your life. You're 72, your retirement age, of course. Are you able to retire?
I am not able to retire. In order to be able to manage my household, pay my bills, buy food, you know, just do the normal things that everyone does, I've got to continue to work.
You joke about wanting to retire someday, and you say, well, 15 minutes before I die, maybe, right? I mean, it's no joking matter, but it's been this is very serious for you in your life.
It absolutely is. I've got two grandchildren. I would love to do what most people do with their grandkids, you know, take them on vacations, do things, fun things with them. It just looks impossible.
Fatima, the pandemic's economic fallout has affected workers unevenly, of course, and I imagine it's been especially hard on Black women. How does that all factor into this broader wage gap issue?
There were two things that happened in the pandemic that I think we didn't pay enough attention to. One was that Black women were more likely to be frontline workers at a time where we didn't have consistent childcare. And so some folks had to just leave the workforce entirely. But the other thing is that Black women were working in a bunch of sectors where there were fast and acute layoffs. And so the unemployment rate was high, and it has not fully recovered. And so Black women already didn't have enough pay going into the pandemic. And on the other side of this pandemic, I have real, real worries about their employment futures. Even as Black women are looking for work, will they be pressed into grabbing the first job offer they can get, even if the pay is too low, even if the conditions aren't right? That's the sort of pressure not having an ability to save puts on you.
Vinorica, you work in food services, an industry that's been, of course, turned upside down during the pandemic. Tell us how this has affected your work and your financial stability.
I do work in food services, and what I'm doing is I work as a banquet server, banquet bartender. The banquet industry is one of the industries that'll come back last, basically because they're usually for large groups of people gathering. I work in the District of Columbia. I work in venues where people from out of the country and out of town come in a lot, and folks are still scared of that. So as Fatima has said earlier, we don't have savings. A lot of us don't have savings. I know I don't. Have no savings, my coworkers don't, and we're struggling to try and find a way to be able to take care of ourselves. It's hard.
And every time you may have a little extra, someone in your family needs help, or, you know, there's been a health emergency, so you can never really get ahead.
Can't get ahead, not like this. I am fortunate that my coworkers and I started a pod where we got together, and I work 2 and 3 jobs. So I got people from various jobs where I work. We got together and we started a pod back in, I think, April of 2020, when we realized that we probably would be out a long time. And we started talking about how we could survive. How can I get money for medicine? How can I get money for groceries? How can I be one of those people that's not going to be in this new thing that's coming, the next wave, which is, eviction. We inquired and were able to get a deferment, or got our rents or mortgages set on the back burner so that you could, 3 months from now, you can pay it. And then 3 months from now, when you couldn't pay it, they said, okay, well, we'll give you another one of those. And it adds up and it adds up. And who's got that money? Mm-hmm. So eventually people will be evicted. That's what's going to happen. Large numbers.
And rent aside, I mean, you owe $500 on the water bill, and then there's groceries. The list goes on.
The list goes on. I'm in a position right now where I have to move, and my credit's not good. I have no savings, so I'm looking at, where do you move? You don't want to move to a park bench. You don't want to move to a shelter. It was a struggle throughout life, but I never had to. It was never like this.
Fatima, when you hear stories like Vinorica's, what goes through your mind?
Well, I'm just very much reminded that everyone needs to keep Vinorica in mind when we're deciding what to do next, when we're deciding if it's time to raise the federal minimum wage and make it so that tipped workers can also make one fair wage, when we're deciding whether or not we do a major investment right now in our future, in housing, in our care economy. You know, we are a country that can do really big and important things when we need to. And the emergency of this pandemic has not ended for many, many individuals.
You know, what's so interesting as I continue to read your work is that education often gives women an economic advantage, but the wage gap for Black women actually gets wider for women with college degrees and advanced degrees, which seems counterintuitive. Why is that?
It really is a story of the wages that Black women are able to make at every place in their career, even when they're in the highest paying fields. You know, we've looked at lawyers, we've looked at doctors, we've looked at people working in finance. There's a giant gap with what Black women are paid. Some of it is the concentration of jobs, and you have to focus on that. But some of it is good old-fashioned stereotyping and undermining of Black women's ability to reach their full potential at work. And that's a harder conversation to have.
What needs to happen, Fatima, to close this gap? What kind of policies would lead to real change?
Well, we really do have to raise wages we have to raise the minimum wage. It is a national travesty that the federal minimum wage hasn't been raised in over a decade, and that includes one fair wage. But we also have to do things like pass the Paycheck Fairness Act so that when people are in the same field and experience pay discrimination, they have real tools to address it. And I have to go back to the opportunity in front of us. As Congress is looking to move forward a major investment, we can't limit that investment to sort of the physical hard infrastructure. A lot of jobs for Black women, frankly, aren't yet. We have to ensure it includes support for families, things like the child tax credit. We have to ensure it includes a major investment in childcare, in paid leave.
Vinorka, as we talk about those initiatives, what do you want policymakers to know about your life and what you go through every day?
Well, I'd like them to know that we're not a bunch of lazy people that don't want to do anything for ourselves. We're hardworking people. And hospitality, I got into it when I was 12 or 13 years old. Now, that's a long time to have been in an industry. And I got a job at a concession stand at the Arena Stage Theater. And I was 12, and I've been working ever since. I work two and three jobs, and I do that because that's the only way we'll survive. So when that one job is not enough and you have to put out time to work other jobs, you can't give your family the time that they need and deserve.
Fatima Gosgraves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. Fatima, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Vinorka Tucker, who is a 72-year-old food service worker in Washington, D.C. Vinorka, good luck to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. After a year and a half of broadcasting from our bedrooms, we are returning to shows with real live audiences starting August 5th in Philadelphia. Don't worry, we will still have our beds on stage with us. Join us.
Decorated Olympian Simone Biles made her Olympic return today, securing a bronze medal for her balance beam. That's another Olympic medal for Biles, which means she now has a total of 32 Olympic and world medals. NPR's Leila Fadel joins us now from Tokyo. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Leila, a lot of people wondered if they'd get to see superstar gymnast Simone Biles compete again in this Olympics. She pulled out earlier, citing her mental health, but then she got back on the beam and took a bronze. What was it like inside the arena watching her?
I mean, the only word I can use to describe it really is triumphant. When Simone Biles really nailed her routine, everybody stood that was in the arena, and for a moment that emptiness kind of disappeared because the claps were so loud and echoing through. And so for her, it really felt like a triumphant comeback to an Olympics that she struggled through.
The judges gave her balance beam routine a score of 14.0. Can you explain what that means?
So these routines are scored on the difficulty level and the execution of the routine. And as I mentioned, I mean, Simone really nailed this routine. But she pulled out partly because she's suffering from something called that gymnasts call the twisties, this dreaded phenomenon where you're kind of lost in the air when you twist, which is second nature to gymnasts. And so to compete, she simplified her dismount, bringing her difficulty score slightly lower, even though her execution was higher than her qualifying score. Mm-hmm. She still got an Olympic medal despite suffering from the twisties, a testament to what an incredible athlete Simone Biles is. Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, she withdrew from several Olympic events earlier last week. Here she is speaking earlier today about her mental health block.
Yeah, well, to bring the topic of mental health, I think it should be talked about a lot more, especially with athletes, because I know some of us are going through the same things and we're always told to push through it, but we're all a little bit older now and we could kind of speak for ourselves. But at the end of the day, we're not just entertainment, we're humans, and there are things going on behind the scenes that we're also trying to juggle with as well on top of sports.
So Biles talked about having the twisties, as you mentioned, this mm-hmm. mental block where you lose your spatial awareness in the midst of these complex skills.
Right.
when the twisties strike, what then? And is it less of a risk on the balance beam?
Well, she basically said it's like her wires were crossed. Her mind couldn't control her body suddenly. It started after the qualifiers during practice, and she suddenly couldn't control herself, which is why she simplified her dismount, didn't do any twists in her balance beam routine. This is considered one of her weaker activities as a gymnast, and yet she still got that bronze. And she also talked about the pressures that elite athletes are put under. Her aunt died a couple days ago, and she competed here. She said that this wasn't something she ever wanted. She didn't want to be a cheerleader when she was physically fit, when she worked her whole life for this moment, but she had to prioritize her mental health. And she said she's gotten a huge amount of support and love, but she also has gotten a lot of attacks online. So she said she buried her Twitter app on her phone so she wouldn't look at it, because that's just not healthy for her right now.
Has she talked about the future? What happens after Tokyo?
She said she's still trying to wrap her head around this Olympics. She hasn't even thought about 2024 Paris. She has a tour coming up. And at this point, she says she hasn't even thought about Paris.
That's NPR's Leila Fadel in Tokyo. Leila, thank you.
Thank you.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is denying allegations today that he broke federal and state law by sexually harassing 11 women, including a state trooper assigned to protect him. Here's New York Attorney General Letitia James, who released the findings of her investigation earlier today.
We should believe women, and that what we have an obligation and a duty to do is to protect women in their workplace. And what this investigation revealed was a disturbing pattern of conduct by the governor of the great state of New York.
Joining us now is NPR reporter Brian Mann, who's long covered Governor Cuomo. And Brian, this report was 5 months in the making. Some of the accusations, we'd heard them before, but it was frankly surprising to hear some of the other details. What stood out to you?
Yeah, this was shocking in how granular it was, how much corroboration investigators say they found. They describe criminal behavior involving 11 women, say that this governor created this toxic work environment, a pattern of retaliation against women who raised complaints. As you mentioned, one of the people involved was a New York State trooper who investigators found was actually reassigned because Cuomo was allegedly attracted to her. Another state trooper allegedly saw the improper behavior involving this young woman. This really, taken together, Peter, creates a portrait of Andrew Cuomo that is devastating. Details of him touching their bodies, saying things that are highly, highly inappropriate over a period of years.
Well, Cuomo is denying that he broke any law. And today, in a recorded statement, he referenced Charlotte Bennett and her lawyer. Bennett is one of his accusers, also his former executive assistant and advisor. Let's listen.
They ascribe motives I never had. And simply put, they heard things that I just didn't say. Charlotte, I want you to know that I am truly and deeply sorry.
What kind of tone is the governor taking today?
Yeah, clearly digging in, giving absolutely no ground here. At times in his statement, he used the language of feminism, the language often used by people in the Me Too movement, people defending women from sexual harassment. He attempted to use that language in his own defense. That will be very, very controversial given the gravity of these allegations. Basically, what he's saying is that he is misunderstood here over and over and over again. But this attorney general, this detailed report says that there was clear corroboration that women say that this was obviously improper behavior.
At this point, how likely is it that the governor will be pressured to resign or be impeached by fellow Democrats at the State House?
So he seemed to put to bed any idea that he will go willingly today. This was a moment when I think a lot of people were watching to see how he would respond. And again, this looked like a guy who is digging in for a big fight. He says he wants to face some of these allegations in court before a judge and a jury. Now, really, Peter, where the pressure is on New York State Democrats. An impeachment process is underway. There have been complaints that Carl Hastie, the assembly speaker, has sort of been dragging his heels on that. Carl Hastie put out a statement just a few moments ago calling these allegations gut-wrenching, saying that they will now move forward in the very near future. So I think that there is going to be enormous pressure from Democrats in New York State to try to clean up what has become a toxic political problem, a toxic optics problem. And again, Governor Cuomo made it clear today that he's not going to make that easy for them.
All right. We'll keep a close eye on the story as it develops. NPR reporter Brian Mann in New York, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
And let's get back to pandemic news now. Officials at nursing homes and assisted living centers are growing increasingly concerned about the rapid spread of the Delta variant. Last year's lockdowns isolated many seniors from family and friends, and almost one-third of all U.S. deaths from the disease have been in nursing homes or other long-term care facilities. Joining us now is Dr. Kevin O'Neill. He's chief medical officer at ALG Senior, which operates more than 130 assisted living centers in 8 states, many of them in the southeastern United States. Dr. O'Neill, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thank you very much, Peter. Nice to be with you.
It's nice to be with you at this difficult time, though, because the southeastern United States is experiencing significant surges with the Delta variant. In fact, all states are. Has it made its way into your assisted living centers?
Happily, we've only had 2 cases so far. We're being very aggressive about our infection prevention and control measures. But it is a concern, naturally. We had 0 cases over the last couple of months, and now with the surge of the Delta variant, as you know, is a lot more transmissible. So obviously very concerned about the potential that it could have to cause increasing cases. But we've had great success in getting our residents vaccinated, and we're having quite a bit of success getting our staff immunized. That's really important as well, because it's often a staff person who can bring the infection into the community and cause a problem.
Why don't we talk about the vaccination rates? We'll get to the staff, but first, your residents. What percentage of your residents are protected with a vaccine?
It's over 90% now. Obviously, we want to get that to 100%. We're doing all we can in terms of education, overcoming some of the cultural barriers that might exist, and you know, a lot of the myths that have been propagated out there. So we've had great success with the residents. On the staff, initially, it was quite concerning for us because we did a survey, and about 30% of the staff said that they would get vaccinated. The other Another 30% say they're undecided, and then another third thought that they weren't going to get vaccinated. So had a very intense education campaign, a lot of town hall meetings, one-on-one conversations. Happily, we've got that up to about 70%, but our goal is really to get it to nearly 100%, and we're continuing to work on that. As soon as the FDA goes on to the final approval of the vaccines, as you know, they're under an emergency use authorization right now. We will make it a mandate, just as we have with the influenza immunization.
Why not make the vaccine mandatory now? Why do you need to wait for full authorization?
I think the opportunity that we have to care for our staff and let them know that we're concerned about their concerns, but the final appeal that we've made is that, you know, as a healthcare worker, you have a moral obligation to the care and safety of your patient, of the residents. And so, you know, that principle of autonomy, you know, our ability to make our own decisions about our healthcare, that ceases when it jeopardizes the safety and health and welfare of the population. So, and as you know, we're dealing with a very vulnerable population, advanced age, multiple medical problems, you know, many are immunocompromised. So we've made it clear to our team that, you know, we do have a moral obligation to protect them. They expect it and their families expect it.
Well, in fact, a significant portion of COVID deaths in the last year or more have been in nursing homes. It's where we saw the outbreak in the earliest days. It was terrifying.
Yes.
Are you trying to get ahead of that with other precautions?
Yeah, we're making it very clear to our team that, you know, we can't forget the basics. I mean, the basics are really important in terms of infection prevention and control. So, you know, hand hygiene, washing hands for at least 20 seconds, The social distance continues to be important. The use of the masks, making sure they're worn properly over the nose and mouth, and continuing to, just don't let down our guard. Don't get complacent. That's the biggest danger.
Are you at the point yet where you have considered restricting visitors?
Yes. Well, we're still going through the intense screening process, making sure that everyone's screened appropriately. We are testing our staff more frequently. We've gone back to testing our staff every single week. And the unvaccinated staff, we're actually testing twice a week.
Hmm. And visitors, do they have to prove that they're vaccinated before they can come in?
We ask them about vaccination. Depending on state laws, you know, people do not have to answer that. And we make it very clear, though, that anyone who passes the screen still needs to practice infection prevention control measures that we know work, so that even if someone did have COVID and was not symptomatic, you know, by wearing their mask, maintaining that social distance, they're not going to transmit it.
Yeah. Dr. Kevin O'Neill, Chief Medical Officer at ALG, Senior operates assisted living centers in the southeastern United States. We wish you continued good luck as this Delta variant surges.
Thank you very much, Peter. Stay safe.
Back to school is just around the corner for many families, and this will be a year unlike any other as the pandemic continues. While navigating the mask debate that's going on across the country, parents also have a lot of questions about how to manage the social and academic aspects of returning to class. Abby Freireich is a teacher, tutor, and a parent who is the co-author of Homeroom, an education advice column for parents from The Atlantic. Abby, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Jane. Great to be here with you.
So you've been getting a lot of questions from parents that we want to get to, but first we need to address masking. I personally have two high school kids who were quite upset when they heard they'd have to wear their masks again this year at school. It's so hard for these kids after everything they've been through. What are you hearing from kids and from parents about masking up yet again at school?
So I think your kids are in the majority of children who are not thrilled about the idea of having to wear masks. My sons are definitely firmly in that camp as well. The reality is that parents have very mixed reactions to wearing masks. I think that it really in general correlates to the vaccination rate. So areas where vaccination rates are high, parents tend to be more pro-masks in the classroom, whereas in regions of the country where vaccination rates are lower, parents may be a little bit more anti-kids wearing masks, and everyone, of course, is eager to get back to normal. The question is how soon to do so and what are the risks in doing so?
Yeah. Well, here's another important question that you've heard from parents. It's been nearly 2 years of remote or start and stop in-person learning. How can I make sure that our kids catch up to where they should be? What do you think, Abby, about that question?
This is a really tough question that teachers and parents are all grappling with. I think all parents have a profound sense of anxiety now about how are we going to catch up? Are we ever going to catch up? The reality is that parents should try their best not to impart that sense of anxiety to their kids, because all kids right now are also feeling anxious for a whole host of reasons, and that it's really the teacher's job to assess at the beginning of the year where kids are. Some kids are going to need shoring up in terms of foundational skills. Other kids will be at grade level. And really, teachers are going to have to assess and reassess throughout the year to figure out what those benchmarks are. And perhaps more importantly than academics is also the social-emotional piece and being attuned to how kids are doing throughout the school year with all of these changes.
That kind of tees up the next question, which is, how can I prepare my child for social integration in school after so much time being remote?
So I think one of the most important things is to scale back on screen time. So many kids have been remote, they've been on their iPads all day long, both for academic purposes and for socializing. That's really been the only way that they can connect with their friends. So I think having parents organize get-togethers with their friends, with kids and their friends, to set up play dates or to really have that in-person interaction and scale back on the screen time, which can be incredibly isolating for kids and can make it more difficult to reintegrate socially into the classroom thereafter.
We have this question that I'm sure a lot of parents can relate to. After the stress of the last school year and a half, should we let our kids just be kids for the last few weeks of summer, or should we try to prepare them for the upcoming school year? What do you think, Abby?
I think this is a question that all parents are grappling with at this time. And the reality is, I think it's most important to just let kids be kids to the degree possible in these very stressful and uncertain times. All kids have gone through so much stress in the past couple of years. So I think where possible to let them get outdoors and recharge and socialize with one another, that really needs to be the number one priority. That being said, if parents are really anxious about the upcoming school year, there are low-key ways to integrate learning into the summer. So if kids, for example, need to work on arithmetic, they could have a lemonade stand and work on making change, or, you know, just making it low-key and finding what their interests are and going with an academic route through those interests versus trying to impose a lot of work at the end of the summer, I think is key.
I have to say it's been really important for me to really validate the emotions of my kids who've been through so much, as all kids have in this pandemic, mm-hmm. socially, emotionally, academically, just acknowledging how hard it's been and may continue to be. How can parents right. best do that, Abby?
I think the most important thing is before the school year starts to sit down with your kids and to have an honest conversation with them, just to get their point of view on how they're processing this unusual time and to acknowledge that things aren't back to normal and that we're all trying to figure out what normal really means in the first place. And I think what's really key right now is for parents to encourage their kids to self-advocate. So whether kids have a question in class that they'd like to ask their teachers because they're curious about something or need clarification, or just to check in emotionally and socially to see how kids are doing, that's really paramount at this point in time.
Good advice. Abby Freireich is co-author of Homeroom, a column in The Atlantic helping parents navigate their children's education. Abby, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.